what's the point of a golf course at that level if the ball's going 375 yards? There is no point to it. There is no point to golf if every par four is a drive and a wedge, and you can't keep extending tees. You can't. So, you know, this is the right decision.
I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
Hello, this is Alan Shipnuck, back for another Fire Drill podcast. We started talking rollback, Matt Janella, Michael Bamberger, and myself. We ended that because Michael Clayton called in from Melbourne. You know Michael Clayton as the co-architect of Barn Boogle Dunes, a neoclassic down in Tasmania, longtime tour player in Australia and in Europe. A great thinker about the game. And without further ado, let's go to Clates, who's coming in hot.
Well, I've been on about it for 20 years, which is about as long as everyone else has. Since the Pro V, there's a whole bunch of issues. For the best players, it fundamentally changed the way golf courses play because the ball goes so far. So if you'd said that to Alistair McKenzie 100 years ago, that in 100 years' time, the vast majority of par fours were going to be only driving 8 irons. And the other six holes were 6 irons, 7 irons, 2 5-irons. Now, if you'd said to the great minds of golf of 100 years ago that this is what the game's going to descend into, is a succession of massive drives and short irons, they would be horrified at that because that wasn't the way they thought the test of golf. That wasn't what they saw the questions a golf course asking. That they all assumed and thought the golf course would ask occasionally that a par four was a test of a drive and a wood, lots of long irons, you know, Tillinghast and Wingfoot, you know, it was about drives and long irons. And that has largely completely gone from the professional game. Mike Wine asked Rory pre the Scottish Open, when was the last time you hit more than a 6 iron to a par four? I don't remember. You know, it's clearly a ludicrous situation when a golf course architect and a golf course can't ask the best players in the world to hit more than a 6 iron to a par four ever. And it really happens.
So the question now is the USGA and the RNA have decided to take a stand, but did they go far enough? I mean, is this rollback going to have a material difference on how the game is played, or is it more symbolic than anything else?
If they went back to the distance Jack and Greg hit the ball in the mid-80s, not Jack in the 70s, Greg and Norman, when Norman was a massive hitter, he probably wasn't the top of the driving distance on the PGA Tour. But he was in the top three. He was driving it somewhere around the mid-270s, 280s, say. That would be a reasonable, you know, was anyone saying golf was broken in the 80s when the ball was going as far as it was? And sure, courses have lengthened since then. But, you know, in 2028, when they're rolling the ball back and the ball's, and it's going to be going further in 2028 than it is in 2023, because there are just more young kids coming out who hit the ball further. So what are they rolling it back? You know, 5%, 10%, 5% maybe? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah.
So not going to make that much difference, I don't think. Well, you know, it's what's 5%? So it's 15 or 20 yards. It'll help. And it'll help with, you know, Elvis last week, his routine 8 iron. It became a bit of a joke by the end of the week because we had the exact 160 meter number 5 times during the week, like exactly on one. So 175 yards, that's an 8 iron.
The rollback has not gone far enough. So one thing that Matt and Mike and I were kicking around was, why not a tournament ball just for the major championships that protect these old golf courses? Would you support that?
No, because what about Australia? Does anyone care about Royal Melbourne? I mean, you know, the problem with this debate is it's entirely American-centric now that affects America. I mean, you know, there are 2 points. We went through a rollback, an effective rollback. The Open in 1974 went to the big ball. Then the tour in Australia I think in 1978. I think the 77 Open was a small ball tournament. 78 was a big ball tournament. It was the first one I played in. Europe about the same time. So, you know, and no one in America cared that we all lost 25 yards. And it was a much bigger change. The size of the ball changed. Yeah. Every shot changed. Chips changed. Bunker shots changed. Putts changed. It was way more difficult to play in the wind. You know, I mean, everything changed for us, and no one in America gave a damn that we all had to change. And of course, the unintended consequence of that was the great generation of foreign players. That you know, arguably that never would have happened. Ballesteros, Norman, Price, Langer, Felder, all those guys, Lyle. If they'd been switching, which was happening in Australia, you know, David Graham would come back and he'd want to play the big ball because he was playing in America. He hated switching balls. And well, everyone hated switching balls back and forward. So it was a great thing that had happened. And the unintended consequence was that generation of players who all of a sudden didn't have to change balls and who had to hit the ball better because it was more difficult to use the big ball. So now I've lost track of what I was saying because that was off the point. So no, I wouldn't just endorse it for major championships because what about courses in Britain and Australia for tournaments here? So
I guess it'd be more like a tournament ball that any tournament could invoke that rule.
Adopt.
Yeah.
So, of course, the Australian Open would adopt it and probably the Japanese Open. But then you've got this mess of players switching balls again, which is where we were at last time. And players hate switching balls. Oh, you either change or you don't. But yeah. I think it's got to be a worldwide thing. You know, I always thought bifurcating the game was better because we had a bifurcated game and it was just fine.
Right.
You know, and of course, this is a compromise, and a compromise, no one's ever happy. The amateurs are pissed off because they're losing distance, even though, you know, again, it's an American-centric debate. The evidence of our rollback, which was a small to a big ball, was that no one cared. Everyone just said, that's a good idea. And they changed, and everyone changed. And, you know, Peter Thomson objected because his view was, why are we blindly following America? Which was, you know, not long after the Vietnam War, where we blindly followed America into the Vietnam War. So that wasn't a very good idea either. But, you know, that was a reasonable point of view. Why are we just blindly following America? Because you know, there were two reasons for the, well, the small ball was better in the wind and it was easier to use in the wind. And there's much more wind in Australia and Britain than there is in America. But my understanding is the Americans began to use the big ball because it sat up better on the lusher fairways. You know, way back when they made the ball bigger, I don't know when they did it, the 20s or 30s, whenever they did it, was because the small ball sat down in, you know, the wetter lusher fairways in America, the small ball sat down more. So they just made the ball bigger to make it easier to hit. I think that's what happened.
Amazing. It is a funny chapter that modern golf fans have forgotten about completely, that we've already gone through this as a sport. But
well, that's kind of my big beef is that, you know, you get on Twitter and the Americans are going nuts about this. Well, we all went through this. This wasn't that big a deal. But it's, you know, it's maybe a bad analogy, but when we had a gun massacre in 1996 and 35 people were killed in Port Arthur, the Conservative Prime Minister said, that's bad. We're going to buy back guns and we're going to restrict people's ability to use and buy guns. And everyone said, that's a good idea. You had Sandy Hook, and if that didn't stop, you know, so Americans react much differently to Australians and probably Europeans. And
geopolitics has entered the chat, but
hold on. Let me just jump in here for a second. Because first of all, Jim Jeffries and his, just having you talk about the guns and stuff, the Jim Jeffries comedic,
that's brilliant. Yeah,
is one of the things that I actually watch to give myself like therapy over what's happening with guns in America. It's like I just listen to that and it gives me at least a little. I'm able to laugh about a really sad and horrific situation.
Yeah, it's an amendment.
You can't even do him justice. Watch Jim Jeffries on guns if you haven't seen it. I've watched it 472 times. It's brilliant. Michael, I'm listening to you. I have nothing but respect and admiration for you, your place in the game, architecture, your opinions. So I've been listening, and I read what you write, and I hear what you're saying. You're caddying for these young players, but you know, for me, and you, yes, I'm American centric because I'm in America, and I've been a part of the game since, you know, covering the game since 95, and have watched the game struggle, ebb and flow, shrink, grow, shrink again. Here we are at this height of this boom in America with golf. Everybody's coming to the game, and we're coming at the game. The game has evolved, right? We were just on the phone and did a podcast on Jay Blasi redoing a par three course at Golden Gate Park. We know Goat Hill Park, and Jeff comes and plays Persimmons at a 4,500 yard par 65. And that place is booming and it's great. And people can roll back there or not roll back. And we have this, you know, all those Grow the Game initiatives and all those youth initiatives and all this momentum and growth for the amateurs, for the people who pay to play, is in a really nice, beautiful, healthy place. Now, some would argue we have too many people. Oh, they're not, the etiquette is bad. And I feel like over time, we train them up. We get more people playing the game, and more people playing the game means more good people, because the game fosters good people, right? We learn community, camaraderie. We travel to play the game. By traveling, you experience different cultures. Different cultures means you get more information. More information means less racism, less bullshittery that relates to the other sort of components of general life and the way we consume the world around us, right? All those things are why we, I think we can all agree, the common bond here is that we love the game, right? You love the game. I love the game. We come at it from different perspectives. You're really in the ropes of the professional game and seeing these guys go driver eight iron from 170. And that hurts you, right? That hurts you. What hurts me is the governing body's contradictions of like, grow the game, grow the game, grow the game. Ah, hold on. We grew too much, or the ball's going too far. And now we're going to pull full stop on the people who pay to play, right? People rocking up. And the general perception being that whether it's 5 yards or 15 yards or 0 yards, whatever it is, it's just this PR nightmare that they've unleashed right now, today, on the masses, and the game being dragged professionally through this horrific situation from a professional standpoint, and then throwing the AMs into a similar PR nightmare just feels like it doesn't make sense. Why just the ball? Why not shrink the club heads? Why not grow the fairway length? Well, you know, hard and fat, the fairways at the old course were running faster than the green. Like, there's so many other factors to me to pinpoint the ball, to say that this is the issue and this is what we're rolling back and this is how far we're rolling back and we're doing it in 20. Like, to me, it's like, it's so unnecessary. And that's what hurts me.
Well, I don't think the ball is clearly not the issue. The ball is the solution. The issue is, you know, the complete failure of the USGA and the RNA to administer something that controlled the size of the driver head. When the Great Big Bertha came out, they should have said, that's it. You know, so what I think came with the oversized driver head was longer shafts. Because if you put a 43.5-inch shaft in one of the modern drivers, it looks completely out of scale and looks ridiculous. And if you put one of today's shafts in an old persimmon head, it also looks ridiculous. So the scale of the length of the club, which has all contributed to the ball going further. Now, people say the ball runs further. There was no run last week at the Australian Open. The ball was not moving on the fairway more than 5 yards. So short, and it's always run forever at St. Andrews. You know, and my counter to that, one, it's been a lot of it's been a COVID-induced boom, and two, that go back. We went through this before and nothing, no one complained, nothing happened. The game, you know, arguably the game grew in the 80s when everyone lost 25 yards and went to play with the big ball, which was a bigger change than this. For the average player, it was a much bigger change to change the size of the ball, and the game did just fine. So I don't see that the game is predicated around how far the ball goes. The other point I would make is that, to agree with you, the best thing the administration could do was take away all the restrictions and make a ball that went 50 yards further for women and old guys and probably half the people who play golf. So why is my wife's mother playing golf with the same ball Rory McIlroy is? It's ridiculous. Make a ball that goes further if you can. You know, wouldn't that grow the game more than anything? Was if you, you know, for the, you know, for the majority of amateurs who play the game, if the ball went further, wouldn't the game be more fun?
Yeah, and the other thing is, I think we all agree that bifurcating is the answer, and unfortunately, you know, that got declined or denied at the elite level, and so therefore here we are. You know, I look at pickleball is one of the fastest growing sports in the U.S. because it's a mini version of tennis. We see short course, top golf, par three courses. You know, as I pointed out, look at Bandon Dunes, the last four editions, short course, putting course, short and fun course in the Sheep Ranch, and another short course, because Kaiser's hyper-focused on the retail golfer and making sure people want to keep coming back. He's creating more short cradle at Pinehurst and the short course at Whistling Straits and Forest Dunes, and over and over and over again, short is happening. The game is evolving. We are making adjustments because of time, playability, affordability, accessibility, all those things. It feels like they say, oh, not doing anything wasn't an option. In fact, as it relates to the people who pay to play, I think it was an option. And I was saying earlier when we were talking with Bamberger, if the USGA is sitting on a pile of cash and the RNA is sitting on a pile of cash, why don't they cut out the middleman, not deal with the manufacturers, make their own tournament ball, set up a $20 million purse that's called the US Open, which is a major championship. Say you got to play with this ball that we made and let everything else fall into place. People who are going to want to play for that kind of money are going to start playing with that ball and practicing with it and using it when they need to, when designated events say we're going to the tournament ball. It feels like then you're addressing the rollback that needs to happen at the venues that need it to happen at, with the players who need it to be, that need to be impacted, and you're leaving everybody else alone.
I mean, that's what's crazy. That was part of, that was the original phrasing of this rollback, was the local model rule. Like, this already would have been done and dusted. It would have been announced today, but the tours killed it. Like,
yes. So it's a case of be careful what you wish for. You know it's the manufacturer's fault. If Wally Ulon or whoever the boss of Titleist is right now has said, this is a good idea, we're very happy to make a ball for the top level of the game, We don't want to bifurcate it, so we'll support this. Instead, they kick and scream and go nuts about it, like every lobby group, like the cigarette companies, like the alcohol companies, like the gambling companies, certainly in Australia. They argue against everything that they think is going to affect their bottom line. So the USGA and RNA said, okay, we'll do it for everyone.
Well, in fairness to them, and I'm not paid by any equipment company, right? We have no ties to any equipment company. But in fairness to, let's say, Titleist, if some restaurant is making really good chicken and they've worked hard at their recipe and they're making the best chicken in town, and someone rocks up and says, sorry, no more selling that type of chicken, you're going to have to use this type of chicken. And they go, well, wait a minute, we've spent years and we've got this chef that specifically makes this famous recipe, and you're going to take, I mean, they are trying to make a living. And that's why I'm saying to the USGA and the RNA, then get in the ball business and make your own ball. Don't be beholden to the manufacturers. If you really want to govern the game, you kind of missed the boat. You lost, the ship has sailed, and you know, 20 years ago you kind of missed. Now you can take matters into your own hands because you've made a bunch of money off of all those guys hitting at that far this long, this many times. You've made the money on the tournaments that you hold. Put it into your own ball and take control of your own situation and pay the price that you missed 20 years ago by not doing what you should have been done back then.
So who's going to use that ball? The European Tour, the Japanese Tour, the South African Tour, the Australian Tour? Well, then it's just a complete mess, because, you know, the players are going to go to, they're going to play the Westchester Classic or whatever, and then the week after they go to the US Open, they're going to change balls. I mean, they're going to hate doing that.
In baseball, Michael, one week you play at Fenway and the next week you play at Comiskey, or the next week you go to Petco and you got to play different length of you know, little different lighting situations, you know, different course. Every golf course creates their own set of different, you know, it's a venue, it changes all the time.
But my argument would be that historically, the evidence of when the game last had that situation, when players would come to Australia, go to Britain for the Open and switch balls, they hated it. In fact, Jack was the one, I think, who said to the RNA in the early 70s, we need to go and we all need to start playing the same ball. So in 74, they switched to the big ball. So, players switching back and forward is going to be a nightmare, I think.
But you're still dealing with the small subset who get paid to play and not affecting the people who pay to play, which is really at the base of all of this. This is a business. This is a game people choose to participate in their off time after they're done with work.
Yeah, that's true. But it goes back to my original point. When they rolled the ball back in Australia and Britain, no one gave up because the ball went shorter. No, right. Golf's a much better game than, I'm not going to play if my ball goes shorter. I mean, either move up a tee or, whatever. But, golf is not about how far your driver goes, I don't think. If the only reason you're playing golf is because your ball goes, what's the average amateur going to lose? 5 yards, 10 yards? He's not even going to notice it, really. Move up a tee or whatever. But the game, the evidence of the last time this happened was, the evidence was the game was just fine. Why you do it because, one, because the ball goes way too far, not for just the players on the PGA Tour or the European Tour, but for the average amateur. I mean, Lucas Michel, who works for me, won the US Mid-Amateur a few years ago. Every hole at Metro is pretty much a driver and a wedge for him, and it's a long golf course. The ball goes – and there are two other things that no one ever talks about. Well, some talk about the problem with – the ball's never been hit further offline. It goes miles sideways now with – For strong young men who are not on the PGA Tour, but who can swing the club at a decent speed, but when the club gets inside and the face is open, there are boundary problems that we as architects are completely unsolvable. Now, the ball goes way further offline than it ever did. So that's a problem. And the other thing I think at having caddied at the European Tour School and watched the Australian Tour and watched Elvis struggle to get on a tour outside of Australia, despite being probably the best young player down here, is you look around the professional game and there are way too many young kids trying to make a living when there are way too few jobs. And the more difficult the game was to play, you would weed the kids out who aren't good enough before they get to play as pros. There are way too many kids trying to make a living out of this game. And when, I keep saying when I played, back in the day, and I don't want to sound like an old grump who just wants to go back to the way it was. But the great thing about a persimmon driver and a ballada ball was it always found the best player in the world at the Open Championship, because if you couldn't hit a persimmon driver and a ballada ball through the wind, you didn't have a hope in the Open. So you look at the guys who won that tournament. Once the Americans started playing, look at the guys who won that tournament. Always the best player, the guy who was playing the best or the best player in the world. In 73, it was Weisskopf. In 76, it was Miller. Jack was always there. Trevino, Seve at the end of the 70s. You really had to hit that ball properly. And since then, we've seen the game get way more fun and way better for the people you care about, Matt, and the people I care about. We all care about the average player. The driver's easier to hit. The hybrid's been a revelation. Lofted wedges have been a revelation. The fact that we got away from ballada so you could buy an affordable ball that wouldn't cut and it would spin, but it flew better through the wind. I mean, so many things that have happened in the last 40 years because of technology that made the game easier to play. And that's been a great thing for golf and the growth of the game. But the unintended consequences are thousands of young kids who all think they're good enough to be pros now. They're all out there. And there aren't enough jobs for them. And it's it's not a tragedy like Gaza's a tragedy or is, but it's a tragedy in the game in that there are these kids who they're never going to make a living out. And the quicker you can weed those kids out of the top level because they're not good enough to play, but the equipment has given them a sense that they're good enough because the ball goes a long way. They shoot low scores. If they can't hit a one-on like Jack and Greg can hit a one-on, they can hit a hybrid club. There are thousands of them out there. And if you made the game marginally more difficult to play for them, it would stop this carnage of thousands of kids out there trying to play.
But even as it relates to the guys on tour, it would be a more interesting game where the driver wedge to me is a problem as just a consumer. It just gets boring.
Well, and people are turning off the PGA. I can't tell you how many people say, I don't watch anymore. It's boring.
Yeah, it really.
But again, Michael, the PGA Tour is in control of their product. This is a product. You know, the governing bodies, just because they're going to say whatever they're saying, the PGA Tour is still going to do what it does. The PGA of America is going to do what it does. Like, I still don't see how or what. Like, there is, you know, the governing body of the NFL is the NFL. The governing body of Major League Baseball is Major League Baseball. The governing body of the PGA Tour is the PGA Tour. They're trying to sell tickets. And if they have identified a problem with what their product is, they need to make changes based on, you know, the eyeballs, how they broadcast the tournament. Like, the PGA Tour has a lot of issues, but like hitting the ball to, or you know, having people rock up and see someone hit a 285-yard drive versus a 315-yard drive, I don't know if that's going to solve their problem. They got real problems.
But the difference, but the difference between baseball and football and those other sports is none of those players are paid as endorsers for the baseball they're using or the football they're using. Every golfer is a paid endorser of an equipment company. The players have a huge voice on the PGA Tour. The equipment companies don't want the ball rollback. And the players are just spruiking their message. That's all they're doing. And players who, I know Ogilvy was, without throwing him in the mess, was that, Jeff, we're not paying you to talk about the ball. Stop talking about the ball. And he stopped talking about the ball. So the players, their opinions are owned and bought by the manufacturers. And Rory and Tiger, the only two guys who are big enough to come out and say what they want to say, because what's Bridgestone going to say to Tiger?
Well, yeah, well, because they've gotten rich
enough. Nothing.
But they've gotten rich enough to be able to have that independence. Well, you know what I mean?
But the players have it, and you know, going back to the chicken analogy, Titleist have always made the best ball, and they've developed a name in golf that they're not going to sell one less golf ball if the ball goes shorter. Because one, they've always made their best ball. And in the last 70 years, they've created an amazing brand. So people aren't going to stop buying Titleist balls because the Titleist ball goes shorter. It doesn't make any difference to their bottom line.
Well, if it's illegal, right. If it's illegal, they'll stop buying it. I mean, you know, in theory, I mean, I could see their point. If you go to the ball factory and you see what they do and put into the R&D and how many decades of money they've spent to be number one, in which, you know, they've earned it, quite frankly. I mean, and then, you know, and then you blur the marketplace and you bring everybody back to a starting point in which you're going to have a lawsuit. And again, why, you know, of course.
I would argue that just positions Titleist to be the most popular maker of the new ball. If people trust them and they've got the R&D.
We'll see. But you can see their argument saying,
So here's a question, Matt. You know, we agree that this is a compromise. Bifurcation would have been better. So in golf, since Ted Ray was a boy, Sam Snead, Jack Nicklaus, who was next? David Slav, probably, Greg, John Daly, you know, Tiger, Rory. Now it's Gordon Sargent. So who flies at, what, 375, whatever his ball speed is. So you know, the history tells us the freak in one generation has always been the norm in the next. So is it okay in 20 years when everyone's hitting it 375 yards? I mean, what happens to the game? What's the point of a golf course at that level if the ball's going 375 yards? There is no point to it. There is no point to golf if every par four is a drive and a wedge, and you can't keep extending tees. You can't. So, you know, this is the right decision. Because the freak always becomes the norm. And you know, people are going to say, well, that's not going to happen now. Well, no one thought that people were going to hit the ball as far as John Daly. When he came out at Crooked Stick, no one could believe how far he hit the ball. Shit, there are women with the ball further than that now. Well, you know, there are five women on the LPGA Tour, I think. It was statistically longer than Greg Norman was in 1985. You know, was there a problem with the game and how far the ball went in 1985? No one thought it was a problem. You know, there was a fair, it was a fair fight between the golf course and the player. It's now a completely unfair fight because the golf courses are, you know, certainly in Australia, they're completely defenseless. You know, and the worst thing about playing the old course now is that because the, and I catered at Royal Cinque in the Open qualifier there, the worst thing about playing those golf courses is you walk back 80 yards through every tee, not every tee, but most of them, because that's the way they've resolved the issue of the ball going so far.
I think you need, you caddy for too many good players. I think that it, you'd walk off on the third hole if you caddied for me anyway, but I think you need to caddy for more people like me who really suck at the game, who've given everything.
Matt, believe me, every Saturday I play with three guys who are really bad at golf. So I know how I watch people play all the time. I mean, we walk around golf courses. The funniest thing, we were walking around a golf course the other day and there were two women playing. You guys walk ahead. They just hate you watching them play golf. They're embarrassed to watch. I see lots of bad players. We deal with them all the time. I know how difficult the game is. But, we're talking about two entirely different games. Which is why you need two sets. I think you need two sets of rules.
Yeah.
But, this is on the manufacturers and the PGA Tour, because they said, we're not going to, the game shouldn't be bifurcated. So the USGA said, okay, it's going to be done for everybody. So, because doing nothing is not an option. And historically, Gordon Sargeant, he's going to be the norm because that's what's always happened. And why is it going to be any different now? There are a bunch of 14-year and 15-year-old kids in there who are being told, if you want to compete as a player on the PGA Tour, you have to swing the club at 130 miles an hour. And your ball speed's got to be 190 miles an hour. So what's going to happen? That's what they're going to do, because that's what humans do.
You know what's going to happen? They're all going to try to swing for 130 miles an hour, and they're going to hurt their backs. And, the Will Zalatorises of the world, the rollback happens naturally and organically because no one can sustain that type of physical activity at anything beyond your mid to late 20s. It's going to happen naturally. You're going to have a younger group of people who come up if the game allows for these people back to your other point of so many people trying to get in and get a piece of the cash that's floating around in the professional game. Cause that's the big carrot and why all those thousands of people are trying to achieve that elite level is because there's money to be made. And only more to your point, there's only a small chunk of people who are actually getting access to that money. So that's again, part of the professional, dilemma, but not many Gordon Sargeants are going to be able to swing 130 mile an hour swing speeds or drive at 370 yards for more than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. How long is he going to be able to do it? And the other thing is that those people that are swinging that large are not just going out and walking away and winning by 10 shots.
Which is the next issue, which this is not about scoring. This is not about scoring.
I agree.
You can distort the dimensions of any golf course in the world to make even par win a tournament. Just do what Seve did and say, just have no fairways. I'll win every week. So, but sure, some of them will get in, but not all of them will get injured. There's bound to be 125 of them who won't get injured. And, the other point about this is, do we want to drive? Do you want to drive a Sam Snead out of the game who was, for three consecutive years in his 60s, finished in the top five in the PGA Championship? Do we never want to see that ever again? Or Jack Nicklaus winning the Masters at 46? Or do you want to...
I don't think actually a great look for professional golf, to be totally
honest. I think it's amazing that... I think
a big old chubby guy walking off the couch and going and winning a major championship.
But Sam Snead was arguably the greatest athlete who ever played the game. The guy was a great enough player in his 60s to finish in the top five in a major championship 3 years in a row. Well, I think he was ninth 1 year and then third and fifth and whatever he was. It was a freaking amazing achievement. Do we want to kill that? But, we've killed the Corey Pavin and Kelvin Peet out of the game. If someone can't hit the ball a crazy distance, well, I consider a crazy distance, they can't play anymore. I mean, why do we want to drive those players out of the game? I mean, how much better was the game for the variety it had? Now it's just all about, if you can't hit far enough, you can't play. Corey Pavin couldn't hit far enough, but he could play because, you know, last I looked, there were 13 other clubs in the bag and he was really good with them. But if you can't drive the ball X distance, you can't compete. It's a horrendous look for the game.
In a way, we're kind of agreeing, you know, we keep landing on an agreement that, you know, a bifurcation would have been the best scenario. Manufacturers, I see their point. It's a business. They're making money. Why would they?
I just don't see that point because I actually don't see that point because if some rocket scientist technologist went to the boss of Titleist tomorrow and said, I've figured out how to make a ball that goes 400 yards, it's legal. They would switch their machines tomorrow to make that ball. They don't give a damn about the consequences on golf courses, on the speed of play, on the boundary problems, who it affects. They couldn't care less. And it's not their job to care.
It's not their job to care.
It's not their job to care. But it's the administrator's job to care about how golf courses play, how far the ball goes offline, you know, the consequences of the distance. It's their job to care. And, you know, they've decided that 400 yards is not the line in the sand. It's 330 or 340. So at what point is it too far?
But again, let's go back to that point about how in other sports, people don't get paid to play that specific bat or play that specific ball because essentially Major League Baseball has a ball that everybody plays and a bat that has to conform. There's, you know, I think there are different versions of a wooden bat or companies that make wooden bats that players can choose from. So why don't the governing bodies, would you be a fan of if today's announcement was the USGA and the RNA were going to go into development with in their own ball and maybe even like it could even expand beyond that, essentially to say these are our rules and regulations to play in our tournament. We're putting up $20 million and let the chips fall where they may.
Aren't Titleist going to say, get out of our business? Why are you in our business?
Well, they're going to say that anyway. They're saying that anyway.
No, I think the manufacturers make the ball. I don't see why. Why should the RNA and the USGA aren't in the business of ball manufacturing? You know, they're in the business of running tournaments. They're not in the business of manufacturing golf balls.
But you eliminate that whole other thing that we're talking about, which is the dilemma, which is the manufacturers are paying players to play, and therefore the players are going to reject a bifurcation. So in order, I feel like we should stay focused on the subset of the game that it truly impacts, which is such a small percentage, and let's stay hyper-focused on that and continue to make adjustments that impact that group of people. The minute you start making adjustments that impact the people who pay to play, in which the game is already hard for them, no matter what we do, it makes no sense. The minute it goes to the masses, it makes no sense to me.
Well, my 2 points that would be, the game's never been easier to play.
But it's still hard.
It's still hard. It's a game of technique, and it's hard to master the technique. And the average player plays to the level they play because of their technique. You know, if you're a 20 handicap player, it's because you've got a 20 handicap swing plane and a 20 handicap grip and a 20 handicap swing. 27, 15, 4, whatever level it is, you play at that level because it's a game of technique. So it's, you know, so I've forgotten, I've lost my point
the
again.
Other, yeah, it's well, hard.
Why not? And my other point would be, people make the analogy of, you know, running tracks and baseball tracks and cricket fields. They're not pieces of architecture. Golf course is unique. A golf course is unique in sports. It's a piece of architecture designed and intended to test a wide variety of skills and to make holes that ask different questions. And until this generation, if an architect built a hole that was a 470-yard par four, he could reasonably expect that hole to test a drive in a long iron or a drive in a mid iron. And he built a green that was appropriate for the shot that was being played to it. Not always, but generally. You know, there were great holes with greens that are wildly, you know, the road hole at St Andrews is not an appropriate green for a long line approach. It's the best hole in the world, and it's an exception that proves the rule. But, you know, golf courses ask those questions. They don't, at the top level, they don't ask those questions anymore. In fact, there are a whole bunch of holes that were designed with greens that were built to receive mid and long irons that are now played to with wedges.
They weren't designed to roll at 11 on the stimp or 12 on the stimp either. They weren't designed, like, you know, there's a lot
that's also true, but that comes, but you know, fundamentally there are a whole bunch of greens that were built for long irons that are now players hitting short irons too. So the game's out of scale. And we're talking about the top level, but it's not just PGA Tour players. There are thousands of people, thousands of great amateurs who they all hit the ball forever. And golf courses don't play the way they used to play, the way that they were intended to play, the way the great minds of, you know, Bobby Jones, and again, you know, he's going back to the past, the way Jones and McKenzie and, you know, the great minds thought, you know, George Thomas and all the great architects, the tests they were making, the way the game the way they saw the game playing and the way it should be played, you know, that's completely gone and lost. And, you know, is Wally Elon a better mind than Alistair McKenzie or Bobby Jones? Whoever's the boss at the time, all they care about is their bottom line and their perception of how this will hurt their business. And I don't think it'll make a damn bit of difference to their business, because they've always made the best golf ball and they've developed an amazing brand. People have a great loyalty to it. They're always going to buy a Titleist ball, whether it goes 250 yards or 280 yards or 330 yards. They're still going to buy their golf ball.
I got to jump in here. I need to catch a plane. I'm coming to see you, Michael. We've been podcasting for over 3 hours straight here.
You're fed up with that?
Now, I'm not so fed up. I'm just out of time. I got to start getting to the airport. But very quickly, let's just tee it up. So, Michael, I am coming your way. I'm heading to San Francisco Airport here to fly to Melbourne to the Sandbelt Invitational. I can't wait. I've been covering this tournament the last 2 years from afar. Now I'll be in the dirt, at least in the sand. Tell the listeners why this tournament is special and what it means to you personally.
Well, we started off in COVID quickly. The kids had nowhere to play, and Jeff Ogilvy and I started a thing called The Game, which was, it was an 18 and 36 hole just chance to play. And they started playing competitive golf, and it was fantastic. And, you know, they embraced it. Now, you know, they play most Mondays. And the Sandbelt tournament sort of evolved out of that, where we went to originally Kingston Heath, Peninsula, Kingswood, Yarra Yarra, and Royal Melbourne. Said, can we have a day at each of your courses to run a four-round tournament? We've won about 35 or 36 pros. And the same number of kids. So men and women, boys and girls. We've got an 11-year-old playing this year, a 12-year-old, a bunch of teenagers, like 13, 14. Amelia Harris, who won last year, is 15. She's like a veteran. I'm just looking at the LPGA Tour school. Robin Choi is now leading at 27 under par. She's leaving the LPGA Tour score that she looks like she's going to win through 15 holes to come and play. Nicholas Kolsatz is playing. Cam Davis, who is amazing, is a defending champion. Jeff Ogilvy is obviously playing. Elvis is playing. So there are a bunch of great young and old pros, young amateurs. It's free to get in. We play a different course every day. Can't tell you how many really good young Australian players sent me emails pleading to play, and I'm sorry, guys, we've only got 36 spots, and I wish I could fit you in and send me an email earlier. And yeah, you know, so it's a really cool tournament. It's free to get in, and you can see Cameron Davis playing with a 13-year-old girl. I mean, last year he played the last two rounds with Momoko Kobori, who's Kazuma Kobori's sister. He had a driver on the 17th hole at Peninsula Kingswood to 8 foot and hold it and beat her by one shot. So she's
a driver off the deck.
Yeah. It was an amazing shot. So the women play off different tees and they play a different par. So the men play, so we cut the men's par down to 70 on, not exactly, but essentially 70 on Royal Melbourne and Yarra Yarra Peninsula. The women's par is 72. And the winning score is relative to par, if that makes sense.
It does. It.
Yeah. So it's a really cool event. And this is the third year, and it's going to be great fun to watch how it evolves.
So really quick, Hugh Foley, our friend from Ireland, a dear friend,
is playing,
which is amazing, and has quite the resume. Second in the U.S. Mid-Am 2 years ago, and won the North and South of Ireland. Not done since I think Darren Clark did it way back when. So you got Hugh Foley, but Jeff flew out from Melbourne to play in the Wishbone Brawl, and on the driving range again, not to talk for Jeff, and we're going to run a clip of his about the Sandbelt. But I love the idea that part of the reason, and I'm sure you can emphasize this, but what Jeff loves about this is that as a kid, he would have loved an opportunity to play with the pros, to pick their brains, to see them, you know, shoulder to shoulder, and watch how they carry themselves, how they practice, how they get ready, how they perform under pressure. And that to me is also a really cool subset of this, is that that's what you guys are providing, is this sort of this opportunity to sort of compete together.
Yeah. Well, it's not so much the subset. It's the whole point of it. You know, it's the mentoring thing. It's like, you know, it's a chance for, you know, Amelia Harris when she was 13 to sit down with Peter Fowler, who was 60 years old, and talk about, you know, how did you play that shot? And how do I prepare? And I'm like, because Chuck is the most rabid preparer for pro golf ever. And Seve once said, the only man with a better short game on the European Tour than me is Peter Fowler. So, you know, and, you know, she was with him for an hour and a half, and he took her down the chipping green, and he showed her how to play different shots. And so that's the whole point of the whole thing, you know, it's the mentoring thing, and it's a really cool tournament. The clubs are great because it's not too much of an inconvenience for the members, because we only spend one day at them. There are no grandstands, there are no TV towers, that, you know, we don't have to pay them any money for the course. It's
amazing.
It's an amazing thing. And Lloyd Cole's in Melbourne on Wednesday night. So Alan, you're coming to see Lloyd Cole on Wednesday night, I think.
I look forward to it.
So that'll be fun. So Lloyd's, of course, a complete golf nut, and Australians love Lloyd Cole. So he's playing in town on Wednesday night. So we'll see how many of the players want to come. Most of them have probably never heard of Lloyd Cole, but anyway,
no,
at least you and I have.
Michael, thank you for your time, and thank you for your perspective and all that you do for the game. And obviously a big, like I said, big fan of your opinion and your architecture. And I've been doing some things on what you guys have been doing, and you got a great team, and so keep up all the great work. And I'm at some point, at the core of all this is we love the game. And I hope someday to come down to the Sandbelt and to walk some fairways
with you. You need to come and play it and see it. And we look forward to seeing you, Alan.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Right.
Okay. Well, Michael, Clayton and I will continue this conversation in person in Melbourne while I'm covering the Sandbelt Invitational. You can follow all that on firepitcollective.com. There'll be daily stories, probably some more podcasts. We'll be doing some fun stuff on social along the way, on my handles and, of course, on the Firepit handles. So, thanks to listening. For those of you who went from Bamberger to Clayton, you're the lunatic fringe of golf fans, and we love you and we thank you for your support. Matt, always a pleasure. I wish I had as much passion for anything in my life as you do for the anti-rollback arguments. It's impressive. But anyway, good stuff. Thanks
Safe
for
travels.
Listening.
Safe travels.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And that's the end of this podcast. Goodbye.
I bet big and I played to win. Made a fortune when my ship came in. I ran the table, never thought I could fall. Then the winter time hit me like a cannonball. And now I can't shake this losing streak. Every road I take is a dead end street. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.